I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti, who says the world is not flat, it's clustering. He calls it the geography of jobs. But first, trouble in two of those job clusters, Silicon Valley and Wall Street. Lawyers and regulators asking, did Morgan Stanley, as it helped orchestrate Facebook's IPO, warn top clients that it might not be such a good deal? And if it did, is that illegal? Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin has subpoenaed Morgan Stanley to find out what analysts told investors. And today, an L.A. law firm filed a lawsuit against Facebook, alleging inadequate disclosure of key information. And there are other lawsuits and investigations as well. Lee Spears is Bloomberg News Markets reporter. He joins us. And Lee, back on May 9th, Facebook revised its IPO filing. It admitted that its ad revenue wasn't so good. So we knew that. So what's the problem?
Yeah, I think the general concern here is that when Facebook updated its filing on May 9th, the language was very vague. And the information that was conveyed by Morgan Stanley to its clients ended up being very specific. So while Facebook said in its filing something simply along the lines, revenue is not growing as fast as the number of users, and basically left it at that, Morgan Stanley and the other investment banks running the deal as well, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, were calling their clients and saying very precisely, you know, this is how we think this will affect 2012 revenue, 2012 earnings, right. 2013 revenue and earnings.
So was there a question as to, you know, what Facebook and Morgan Stanley might have told the little guy, you know, the retail investors, as opposed to what they said in conversations with their institutional investors, the big guys?
Yeah, well, I think as a practical matter, the underwriter is not able to call every mom-and-pop investor on the phone and tell them what they think the forward
right.
valuation estimates are. But again, I think the general concern is that Facebook's public disclosure was very vague. The investment bank's conversations with their top clients
right.
were very specific and gave a very clear idea that the business or certain metrics of the business were trending downward. And I think that is what people are really angry about, given that the stock is not trading well.
Well, and also given the price it started at, isn't that one of the questions? If, in fact, Morgan Stanley analysts like Scott Devitt is one who's been named, were giving this pointed information to institutional investors, why was the stock price so high?
IPO investing is a very risky business. There's a lot of unknowns. It's very non-transparent. And keep in mind that the people who Morgan Stanley and the other underwriters were communicating these downward revisions to are the exact same people who were putting in orders for the stock at the top of the price range.
That was another one of our questions. I mean, why would they do that if you know, Morgan Stanley kind of knew that it was telling investors that this might not be, you know, what it's valued at? We also heard that they were buying the stock early on, propping it up.
Well, that's part of Morgan Stanley's job as an
yeah.
underwriter is to get into the market and buy the stock up to prevent it from falling through some floor.
I guess one of the questions we have is, what is illegal about this? In other words, you know, who is supposed to do due diligence? Is it Facebook that's supposed to tell Morgan Stanley more about the valuation? Is it Morgan Stanley that's supposed to find it out and relay it? Or, you know, if you've got a market hungry to buy into an IPO, can you price it at whatever you want?
Well, yeah, to answer the first part of your question, again, it's very unclear whether anything illegal was done, but on the face of what we know right now, it doesn't seem like anything illegal was done.
Right.
Due diligence is a big part of the job, and if there were any fraud-like activities, say, for example, an underwriter knew something about a company that was blatantly fraudulent and did not tell its clients, well, that would be illegal. But again, all we have here is that Facebook discovered that its prospects were trending downward a little bit. Facebook communicated this to its underwriters, completely legal. The underwriters then communicated this to their clients, also completely legal. The other part of your question is, you know, how do we get to this point? People paying $38 a share for a stock that immediately started to trade down, that's the game of IPO investing. People will pay a higher price for something than they think it's really fundamentally worth. And the bet that they're making is kind of the next greater fool bet, that they'll find someone else who's willing to buy it from them at an even higher price. And that happens a lot of the time on a lot of IPOs. I think one thing that they were really banking on was that there was going to be huge retail demand out there, that lots of mom-and-pop investors were going to be so eager to get their hands on Facebook stock, they would pay any price to get it. And that's what did not happen.
Lee Spears, a Bloomberg News markets reporter, on the latest fallout from Facebook's troubled IPO. We'll continue to follow this. Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, remember when the world was supposed to be flat, where when you lived didn't matter because with email, the internet, you could do business anywhere? Well, our next guest pretty much says, oh, Tom Friedman, that is so 10 years ago. In fact, Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti says the opposite of a flat world has happened. He says there's a sea change going on, a redistribution of population and wealth fueled by innovative companies that need to be in ecosystems to thrive. They need to cluster with like-minded companies in places like Seattle and Boston, where, like beehives, they expand. Moretti says that each new innovative job produces five others in everything from carpentry to teaching. But as these job clusters grow, the rest of the country is shrinking in education, income, even life expectancy. In fact, Professor Moretti says this disparity will be the challenge of the next century. We're going to spend some time with him today. His new book is called The New Geography of Jobs, and he joins us from the University of California at Berkeley. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Have I got this right, that these clusters, they keep attracting other companies even though they compete as well as complement each other?
Yes, you did. If you take a look at the map of the American economy today, you don't see just one country. You see three increasingly different countries. On one end, you have cities like Boston, San Francisco, Austin, or Seattle, with a strong innovation-based economy and the labor force that is one of the most creative and best paid on the globe. At the other extreme, you have cities like Cleveland or Flint or Detroit, with shrinking population and falling wages. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country that seems undecided on which direction to take. Now, these three Americas were not very different from each other in the 1980s and even the 1990s, but have been growing apart for the past 20 years and are now almost different nations.
Well, and one of the striking things about your writing is we can see that in many ways this was sort of a, you'll pardon the phrase, crapshoot, because back in the day, way back in the day, when the economy depended on manufacturing, cities grew around rivers that they needed for transportation and to power mills. But take Seattle. Seattle's growth may have occurred because of one or two business decisions. Albuquerque may have been Seattle. So explain.
That's right. Everybody associates Microsoft with Seattle, but Microsoft was founded in Albuquerque in the 70s. Seattle in the 70s was in very bad shape, so bad that at some point a sign went up on the freeway saying, the last who leaves Seattle, please turn the lights off.
Well, you're the last one to leave Seattle, turn the lights off. It was by the airport. It was a real sign.
It was. And it's still very much talked about today because it's the sign of a city in decline. But then something happened on January 1st, 79, that changed the fortunes of the two cities forever. Bill Gates wanted to move back near his family, which was in Seattle. And so he moved the entire company. At the time, they had only 15 employees. He moved it to the Puget Sound area near Seattle. And that single episode is the seed that is responsible for the growth of the Seattle high-tech cluster, which now is one of the most impressive in the world.
Because in 1994, Jeff Bezos of Amazon decides to move Amazon from New York to Seattle because that's where he's seeing all these programmers, engineers, venture capitalists clustering because Microsoft is there. And this brings us to phrases you use like thickness and knowledge spillover. What is thickness?
Well, in today's economy, a company's success depends on more than just the quality of its workers. It depends on the entire ecosystem that surrounds it. And an important part of the ecosystem is how thick the labor market in that city is, especially for innovative, specialized occupations like software engineers or computer scientists or biotech engineers. And the reason why thickness matters is because in thick labor market, you have many employers looking for workers and many employees looking for jobs. This allows for a better match between the skills of the workers and the needs of the employers.
So in other words, the fact that you have all these companies, even though, as we say, they do compete, although some do, you know, aid each other, you know, you've got vendors that work with the different companies, but even if they compete, they hire each other's workers at times, they all draw workers, and if one doesn't get a job at one place, they go to another, they share ideas, they become this ecosystem you talked about.
That's right. they become more productive and more creative.
But Professor, just let me ask, haven't companies in effect always clustered, you know, car companies clustered in Detroit? And what was good for GM, was good for the country. But as you're saying, what's good for Seattle and that powerful cluster isn't now necessarily good for the country. So what's different?
50 or 60 years ago, the key predictor of a city economic success was the stock of physical capital. Workers in Detroit were particularly productive because they had amassed a vast amount of physical machinery. They had the best machinery, and therefore they were the most productive workers in their cluster. Today, the key predictor of a city's success is human capital, which means education, ingenuity, and people's skill. My research shows that cities that have many college-educated workers tend to develop an innovation-based economy, and this brings even more well-educated workers there. It's a tipping point dynamic.
Well, just to underscore that, you write that for every manufacturing job, it might produce, I think, 1.6 more jobs. But for every innovative job in either Silicon Valley or the finance district, it might produce 5 other jobs because the salaries for these idea-driven jobs are so much higher. I mean, that seems to be one big difference.
This is the most surprising and possibly most important part of the story. The average American worker will never work for Google or Apple, but the rise of the high-tech and innovation sector matters to all of us. And the reason is that for a community, attracting an innovative company results in significant job gains for workers in the local service sectors, those who are waiters, carpenters, doctors, teachers, and nurses. I call this the multiplier effect. And this multiplier effect is surprisingly large. Take Apple, for example. Apple has 13,000 employees in Cupertino, but it indirectly supports 70,000 additional service jobs in the region, which means that, remarkably, Apple's main effect on the local economy is not in the high-tech sector. It's outside the high-tech sector.
I just want to mention one thing you say about investment. You say that there's a new thinking on the part of private investors. They want to be within 20 miles of companies that they invest in.
That's right. And the reason is that venture capitalists are not just cutting a check and then disappearing, but they want to monitor and they want to foster those startups. And that monitoring and that counseling, that fostering process, it's actually one of the key elements for the success of companies. Google is probably one of the most important ones. And so that's another way in which proximity matters and geography reshapes our local economies.
So innovative clusters attract people with money to invest. They attract workers and create knowledge spillover, as we just heard, wage spillover. They create jobs from hairdressers to lawyers and raise salaries as well. Listeners, are you buying it? Are you living it? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, are you in a city that would like to see it? And Professor, let's pick up there. The clusters you talked about were organic. A tech genius happens to move to Seattle, or a biotech pioneer comes to Boston, all the schools here. We've seen cities try to seed clusters. Rhode Island threw a lot of money at former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling's video game company, but they're now having to rescue that company. So this is the unsettling part of your book. How do cities replicate these innovative job clusters?
It's very tough because if you look at historically where the innovation cluster are located, almost none of them was created by some deliberate, explicit policy. It's really hard to engineer an innovation cluster. We talk about Seattle, but if you look at a lot of the clusters, they were all born in very random and often serendipitous ways. So it's really hard for policymakers to be able to engineer from scratch.
You know, it's sort of there's no real easy answer to how to reproduce these.
I know, and I frankly think that's
scary.
That's part of it. Yeah. But I think we should be honest about it.
Well, it sounds like what you're trying to say in the book is that you may not have the answers to how cities and towns can reproduce these clusters, but policymakers need to start looking at it because this is, in fact, what the economy is. And with that in mind, I remember recently there was a heartbeat, a pulse in manufacturing, and people have been talking about subsidizing, supporting manufacturing. You even write that, for instance, China has moved one of its factories to Spartanburg because the cost of production was getting too high in Shanghai, which seemed to sort of underscore what supporters of manufacturing are saying, that it is coming back. But you say what? Is it coming back? Has this idea of innovative clusters completely replaced the old idea of dropping a factory in the middle of nowhere and making widgets?
There is a part of manufacturing that is very innovative, and it's called advanced manufacturing, and makes things that nobody else can make on the planet. And this part is the one that I think we should be focusing on. You know, there are some terrific companies, for example, in Boston that make high-efficient batteries. But the reality is that we're not talking about the typical blue-collar job that people have in mind when you're talking about this type of manufacturing jobs. We lost hundreds of thousands of blue-collar jobs for 30 years. But the number of engineers in the manufacturing sector has actually doubled.
Well, meanwhile, for those blue-collar workers, you talk about this huge chasm between the people who are living lives in these innovative hubs, these clusters, and those blue-collar workers out of work in parts of the country. Huge differences, even in life expectancy. And yet you point out that you know how hard it is for a blue-collar worker to think of picking up stakes and moving to an area that will probably have a much higher cost of living, which these clusters do. And you say an idea might be to give them vouchers to help them to relocate.
That's right. College graduates are very good at finding out job opportunities in other cities and packing and moving. There is recent research that shows that high school graduates are much less able to do so, and high school dropouts even less able to do that. So what I propose in the book is to make part of the unemployment insurance check, to make it as in the form of a relocation voucher that helps people who are trapped, not by choice, but by lack of cash, to move to stronger labor markets.
And here's where you also say something that can be kind of controversial. You say that unemployment insurance might actually tie people to a depressed area. And we need to rethink unemployment insurance. But that plays into the hands of people who, you know, think that people are sort of living off the trough of unemployment insurance. You know, let's cut off unemployment insurance to force people to move to more booming, innovative hubs.
Now, let me be clear. I'm saying that if you are in Flint and you are living off an unemployment insurance check, you have no incentive, by the way the program is structured now, to move to, say, Chicago to look for a better job. Your check stays the same, but the cost of living in Chicago is probably twice as high as in Flint.
And your check wouldn't adjust to that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so all I'm saying is that if there's a group of people who are in Flint not by choice, but because they don't have the upfront cash to finance the move to Chicago, I think we could and should think about making part of the unemployment insurance support to mobility. And actually, if you think about it, it would help both those workers who are in Flint and would like to move, but they can't move because they don't have the cash, as well as those workers who don't move and decide to stay in Flint. Because before, you had 1,000 workers looking for a job in Flint with 100 job openings. Now you have, say you were able to relocate 500 of them, now you have 500 workers looking for a job. And so for a fixed number of jobs, even those who stay in Flint are better off.
Enrico Moretti, his new book is The New Geography of Jobs. And by the way, you also point out that these innovative clusters need to be aware that they could also become Detroits.
Absolutely. A recent research that shows that the rise of Silicon Valley as a cluster tracks very closely the rise of Detroit 15 years earlier as a cluster. We shouldn't forget that Detroit used to be the Silicon Valley of its times. But I would say that what really caused the demise of Detroit was its inability to reinvent its cluster when it still had one. And this is probably the key defining difference between Detroit and Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley used to be all chips and semiconductors in the 70s. And then it became all personal computers in the 80s. And then in the 90s, started branching out into digital entertainment and internet and software. And today it's following even newer venue like green tech, nanotech, biotech. So to me, the real sign of a successful cluster is a cluster that is able to keep reinventing itself every time the economic conditions change.
Or as you say in the book, the new product is not a widget or a car, it's an idea, it's a dream. It's a dream.
Exactly.
Yeah. Enrico Moretti, his new book is The New Geography of Jobs. It's not what you do or who you know, it's where you live. To read an excerpt, you can go to hereandnow.org. He's been speaking to us from the University of California, Berkeley, where he is a professor of economics. Enrico, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Today's talks with Iran mark a possible breakthrough in the year-long impasse over Iran's nuclear program, Iran hinting they might allow inspectors into their facilities. The venues for the talks are a bit unusual. It's Baghdad, the BBC's James Reynolds reports.
Forget the security and the history. The most pressing concern for Baghdad right now is the huge sandstorms which have been coming in the last few days. I've just been driving around Baghdad, and it's difficult to see beyond about 30 or 40 meters. And here in the market in Karada, in front of me at the market stall, there's a film of sand and dust on the tomatoes and the oranges. The sand-coated capital of Iraq is an unlikely choice for a nuclear summit. Nations dealing with extreme weather, bombings, and political unrest tend not to be chosen as conference venues. But Iraq's neighbor and former enemy, Iran, has asked its fellow Shia-led government to host these negotiations. These talks mark a strange reunion. For 8 years in the 1980s, Iran fought against Iraq. Then in 2003, America and Britain led the invasion of Iraq. Now these countries all have their own guest passes. U.S. soldiers once fought their way to Baghdad because of suspicions of weapons of mass destruction. Now, U.S. diplomats come back to the same country to talk about the same subject. This time, the country in question is Iran, not Iraq. For shoppers and traders in Baghdad's Karada market, what happens with Iran isn't the most immediate worry.
My name is Khalid Haj Ali.
What is your thought about Iran?
We don't care about Iran. We want. We care about our country. We want our country to be a safe one. We want security and everything.
What is your name?
My name is Qasim.
Are you afraid of the Iranian nuclear program?
No, I'm not afraid of their program because it's intended for peaceful purposes, not for, you know, military purposes. So.
For diplomats, this is an unofficial Iran nuclear week. On Monday, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, paid his first visit to Iran. He wanted to negotiate better access for his agency's inspectors. He returned to Vienna to say that he had reached a deal with Iran's chief negotiator, Saeed Jalili.
Decision was made by me and Mr. Jalili to reach agreement on the structured approach.
But the promise of better inspections in itself will not end the conflict with Iran. At the heart of the decade-long dispute is Iran's enrichment of uranium. The United States insists that the Islamic Republic has to freeze all uranium enrichment, even if it's just for civilian purposes. But Iran insists that a total freeze is unacceptable. Hussein Mousavian was the spokesman for Iran's nuclear negotiating team from 2003 to 2005.
During our time, we could not compromise to reach a final compromise with EU3 because the US was not on board. And the US position was zero enrichment. The enrichment always has been the red line for Iran. I advise Lady Ashton, do not challenge Iran on its legitimate rights. It is impossible. Change the red line. Your red line would never be responded positively with Iran if the red line is enrichment. But if the red line is nuclear weapon, then you have a chance.
But any agreement in which Iran gets to keep processing low-enriched uranium in exchange for restrictions elsewhere would immediately be challenged by Israel. Still in private, some diplomats refuse to rule it out.
The sandstorms of Baghdad may force the delegations here to stay inside the convention center and negotiate. No one expects a breakthrough at this round of talks, nor do they expect a breakdown.
That report from the BBC's James Reynolds. These days, rap superstar Kanye West is in the headlines for dating Kim Kardashian. Is that a fall from grace? I guess we have to define grace.
Popping bottles, putting supermodels in a cab. Proof.
Kanye West and fellow multimillionaire rapper Jay-Z packed arenas across the country last year with their Watch the Throne concert tour. We're listening to the track Otis from the resulting album. Kanye and Jay-Z singing about their other Mercedes-Benz over samples of soul great Otis Redding.
Last week I was in my other Benz. All your diamonds up, could we in this bitch another game?
Photo shoot fresh, looking like wealth. I'm about to call a paparazzi on myself.
Rolling Stone blasted the pair for focusing too much on their lux lives. But our next guest says that in the song Otis, Kanye West is trying to make himself lovable after years of being a lightning rod. There was that time after Hurricane Katrina when Kanye West said then-President George Bush didn't care about black people. Bush later said that was the lowest moment of his career. There was the time he leapt on stage at the 2009 MTV Video Music Awards, interrupting Taylor Swift's speech for Best Female Video of the Year.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
After that moment, President Obama called Kanye West a jackass. And when asked Kanye or Jay-Z, the president said Jay-Z. Writer David Samuels asked the question. He says Kanye West is the first true genius of the iPhone era, the Mozart of contemporary American music. And David Samuels joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. David, quite a claim. Tell us a little more about Kanye West, and by comparison, which everyone does, Jay-Z. Give us a little biography of both.
Jay-Z and Kanye are both obviously extraordinary artists. They're both very popular. Jay-Z's had this almost at this point 20-year-long career, first as a songwriter, then as an artist, and now as the incarnation of quality rap music.
My life is getting too wild. I need to bring some sort of calm to it. About to lose it. Voices screaming, don't do it.
Kanye is the foremost producer, I think, in pop music today. He's also a very, very talented rapper, and he has this unique ability to create the music that he rhymes to. You can lift Jay-Z's vocals out of their backing track and put them on something else and they sound good. Kanye's tracks are organic in a way that's pretty unique.
Yeah. And individually, Jay-Z, the former drug dealer, now a polished businessman married to Beyonce. Let's listen to a little bit of Jay-Z. This is the song, What More Can I Say, from the Black Album.
And I don't wear jerseys, I'm 30 plus. Give me a crisp pair of jeans, button up. S-dots on my feet make my sight complete. What more can I say? Google Play the beat.
So that's Jay-Z. Kanye West, messier. You know, the son of a Chicago college professor, mom, and an Atlanta-based former Black Panther. Here's a little of his song, All the Lights. This is a song about a parolee trying to beat a restraining order so he can reconcile with his daughter.
I'm headed home, I'm almost there. I'm on my way, headed up the stairs. To my surprise, a nigga replacing me. I had to take him to that ghetto university.
All the lights, top lights.
So David Samuels, there's a little taste of Jay-Z, Kanye West. And that's the, you know, the paper plastic question. What is the president's response, the fact that he immediately said Jay-Z? What does that say to you?
I see Jay-Z as a future mayor of New York. I think he'd be a great political leader, and he's mastered the skills that the president has mastered. Kanye West is the thing that gives Barack Obama hives. He's messy. He's not in control necessarily of what he says in the moment.
And he became a punchline. And you point to the Fish Sticks episode of South Park where Kanye West is portrayed as an egomaniac, the most humorless man in America. He doesn't get what's supposed to be a viral joke about how if you like fish sticks, you must be gay. Let's listen to a little.
The fish dicks joke crosses all borders, all races, all ages and ethnic groups, and is slowly uniting our country. In fact, the only person who appears to not get the joke is rapper Kanye West, who becomes furious when people use the joke on him.
Yo, that is messed up, yo. I am not gay, and I sure as hell ain't no fish, all right? I'm the most talented musician in the world. If I was a homosexual or a fish, I would know.
Okay, putting that aside, there is a little bit of, with Kanye West, this kind of Rodney Dangerfield, almost. And yet he also stood up for Beyonce. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about Kanye West, that person who can't seem to stop compulsively saying what he thinks, whether in defense of someone else or in defense of himself?
Yeah, the Taylor Swift incident was a great example of Kanye being so in the moment that he couldn't see outside of himself at all. It also was, you know, indicative of the weird artistic seriousness with which he takes himself in a genre where we've all decided, you know, hey, it's okay for things to be crappy because it's all kind of crap that we listen to on our way to work. He doesn't treat it that way. It's one of the reasons why his work is so good. And I think that he came to this crossroads where the seriousness that he brought to his craft as a music producer combined with the emotional immediacy and intensity that he brought to writing songs, I think that worked very well for him in the studio where you get to polish and craft. And when you appear in public, you don't have that opportunity, and the public appearances were killing him.
Well, and after that event, he went on sort of a public outreach effort, wrote songs like Blame Game and Hell of a Life.
Let's play the blame game. I love you more. Let's play the blame game for sure. Let's call a name. I hate you more.
And you followed the Throne Tour. And there's such a great metaphor for this struggle on the part of Kanye West to sort of get the respect that he thinks either he or the music that he likes deserve, and Jay-Z's coolness. Kanye West sweat through the concerts, and Jay-Z didn't seem to get a wrinkle.
Yeah, no, Jay-Z has mastered the language of arena rap. He knows exactly what he's doing at every moment. Kanye West stands there, you know, bathed in sweat, panting after running all over the stage. He stares off into the distance looking defeated or lost. And the difference, of course, is that for Jay-Z, this is a performance. This is a business. This is a sport. Whatever goes on inside the private Jay-Z, you'll never see that. Kanye West, it's all out there in the open. And so it's sort of a fascinating contrast in styles.
Yeah.
Let's play the blame game. I love you more. Let's play the blame game for sure.
That's writer David Samuels. His article in The Atlantic about Kanye West is An American Mozart. We're hearing from listeners. Chris B. writes, oh, for God's sake. And then he goes on. Look, David isn't saying Kanye West is as good as Mozart. He's saying he plays sort of the same role in the culture. And he's heard this pushback. We'll ask him about it in 1 minute, here and now. And we're looking at rappers Kanye West and Jay-Z, prompted by The Atlantic's David Samuels, who argues that of the two, it's Kanye who's an American Mozart, despite all his public meltdowns.
Public visitation. We met at Borders. Told her she'd take me back. I'll be more supportive.
That's Kanye's All of the Lights, about a parolee trying to reconnect with his family. So, David Samuels, let's let you make your case, because some of your readers really disagree. One says Mozart was able to compose full symphonies in his head and write them down with no corrections at all. He was composing concertos at the age of 4 and full-scale operas at 12. Another writes, both are Illuminati, but Mozart was a composer. Kanye rehashes funk samples and raps about Gucci and Fendi, where, by the way, he interned. So make your case. Kanye West, not just rap superstar, but an American Mozart.
You know, I chose the title for that piece, American Mozart, because I think that he is the American Mozart, because he's mastered the musical forms and the forms of communication that are native to us in this moment. He understands how to take bits and pieces of songs from the last 50 years and combine them with new beats and rhyme over them, and he can bend his voice and bend words, you know, more supportive and borders. Is that a rhyme? You know, but it's effortless when it comes out of his mouth. And he's, you know, the Mozart of the iPhone.
We're speaking about both Jay-Z and Kanye West. So why isn't Jay-Z the American Mozart? What's the difference?
The difference is that Jay-Z is a very, very talented businessman, and he's a rapper who's created a brand, Jay-Z, and he created a clothing line, and he figured out how to capture increasing percentages of the revenue streams that result from his music, from his live performance, and from his image. Kanye West is an artist. That's what he is, and that's really all he is. He has control over the music that he produces. He creates incredible effects with language, and he has this hunger for expression and for emotional connection that Jay-Z lacks.
Well, in fact, you point to a couple of moments on the tour, one in which Kanye West does something that he, at every stop, but at every stop it seems fresh. It's when he calls for turning the lights up right before the song, All of the Lights. Let's listen to a little of that.
I want to do it like how we did in practice. I want to have all the lights up here. I want to see all the stuff. I want New Orleans to get what they paid for when they want to see
it. You know, it sounds great. I want people to get what they paid for. But as you say, it wasn't impromptu. He did it at every stop.
Now, the All the Lights moment was kind of funny because in each city people reacted to it. They were expecting some, you know, Kanye moment where he goes a little bit nuts. And so people, when they heard this, didn't understand they were listening to a kind of self-parody of, you know, a Kanye moment. This had been built into the script. And there was something sad about the highly scripted nature of the show. To anyone who's followed Kanye, it was very obvious that he had decided, because of this meltdown of his public image, which threatened his ability to be an artist, that he had to sort of yoke himself to Jay-Z, this very, very controlled performer, follow a script, and redeem himself by showing that, in fact, he could be very controlled. Now, of course, his virtue as an artist is not that he's controlled. That's Jay-Z's virtue as an artist. And so following the trip across the country, part of the drama for me was, you know, you have this artist who is trying to redeem himself and refloat his career, and yet the person that he's chosen to ally himself with would seem to promise a kind of artistic death to Kanye. And how is he going to get out of this trap? On one hand, he needs Jay-Z. He needs to stay on script. At the same time, if he does that, that's what Jay-Z is good at. That's not what Kanye is good at. And he sort of found a few holes in that, and the best one was this track on the record, Niggas in Paris.
Don't let me get in my zone, don't let me get in my zone. The stars is in the building, they hands to the ceiling. I know I'm about to.
And he sort of turned this one song into a half-hour-long sort of Kanye West freeform extravaganza where they do the song first three times, then four times, then eight or nine times in a row, until it became this weird kind of abstract art, listening to the same song over and over and over and over and over again, and Kanye West getting more and more excited. And you'd watch Jay-Z kind of enjoy it, you know, just thinking to himself, this is something I'd never do, but it's crazy, and this guy next to me is kind of crazy, and so I'll just let myself go and enjoy it. And in that way, I sort of saw Kanye reclaiming his artistic selfhood, as it were.
But there was one stop in L.A., where he went off script, and this seems to be part of what you're saying, had this sort of impassioned moment with the audience.
I made it from 3 years ago, on the brink of motherfucking suicide. To coming back and making 2 hours, I have the most nominations than anybody. Because I told y'all the truth. Because I told y'all what y'all felt.
You felt in that moment something very true coming from him, this push to not just be good, not just be great, not just sell records, but to transcend some standard that he's created for himself and to keep doing that over and over and over again. And that, to me, is the mark of a real artist. And, you know, I think the comparison to Mozart, of course, it's half tongue-in-cheek, but it's also real. And it's real in the good qualities, the pursuit of greatness, his mastery over these multiple forms, the same way Mozart was able to master the symphony and opera, and the petulance and childlike nature of his artistic creation, the way in which he doesn't understand the careerism and the calculation of other people.
But give me an example of where you hear, even if half in jest, Kanye West as America's Mozart.
You know, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, the record that he released that was up for a Grammy this year, I think that's the best pop music record of the last 10 years.
We at war. We at war with terrorism, racism, but most of all, we at war with ourselves.
There's an emotional nakedness combined with an inventiveness, with melody, an ability to sing, to rap, to create an entirely new sonic texture, and to do that using everyone from John Legend to Chris Rock, beats from the 60s, 70s, 80s. There's just an encyclopedic breadth and ease of reference and inventiveness there. And this is a form, people don't make albums anymore. The album kind of disappeared, 15 or 20 years ago. The ability to do that and to do that with such emotional clarity and depth and such inventiveness is really, it's a kind of genius. And we look at pop music and we say, oh, anyone who works in this debased form automatically is not a Mozart or they're not a Beethoven. But those were the, forms they were working in too.
Yeah.
In fact, Mozart's particular genius rested on his ear for snatches of popular melody and the ability to transform and transfigure them in some larger, aesthetically more complex way, and Kanye has that same ability.
That's David Samuels, a contributor to The Atlantic. You can find a link to his piece, American Mozart, at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much.
Great.
God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down. The only thing that I pray is that my feet don't fail me now. And I don't think there's nothing I could do now to right my wrongs. I want to talk to God, but I'm afraid because we ain't spoken so long. God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down.